Court is in session. Please be seated. We will now hear argument on the constitutional issues, and 60 minutes has been reserved, 30 minutes per side, and we will begin with the intervener's petitioners, Mr. Soto.
Thank you, Your Honor. Petitioners will be voting in reserve for
them. Okay.
Good morning again, Your Honors.
Good morning.
This court has recognized that it defers to the legislature's judgment in enacting social policy. Deciding whether to fundamentally redefine marriage, society's most basic institution, is a social question of the highest order. Thus, my clients respectfully ask this court to defer to the legislature's rational decision to retain marriage as the union of a man and a woman, and to direct the many influential political groups that want to redefine marriage to the legislature for the relief they seek. That is precisely how New York's highest court resolved a similar constitutional challenge to its state's marriage laws. And we respectfully ask the court to follow that course here. Beginning with the Equal Rights Amendment claim that has been raised by the plaintiffs, my clients assert that the ERA does not mandate same-sex marriage. The purpose of the ERA is to prohibit the government from treating men as a class more favorably than women as a class, or vice versa. The marriage laws at issue here do not do that. Every woman can marry a person of the same of the opposite sex, but not of the same sex. Men can do likewise.
Isn't that truly then a difference in treatment? The fact that it doesn't discriminate between men and women as groups, but it is in the choice of one's spouse, the gender, of the person that you choose to marry, that essentially treats different. So the union of is different than that of the two groups.
The purpose of the ERA was to prevent the government from treating one class of sex differently than the other. Here, there isn't such differential treatment. In fact, this court in the NARAL decision did not proceed to the heightened scrutiny analysis until it first concluded that at issue there, women were being disadvantaged.
Sure. Your argument is that men and women are treated the same as groups as long as they choose their spouse to be of the opposite gender.
They're being treated the same, Your Honor, even if they choose a spouse of the same gender. In other words, there's equal treatment regardless. If a man chooses to marry a woman, he can do that.
And if a man chooses to marry a man, he cannot.
But the same is true for women, Your Honor, and there's equal treatment between the sexes, and thus the core purpose of the ERA isn't implicated. In fact, this court stated in the Lynch decision that we cited in our brief that when interpreting constitutional amendments, the most important consideration is to interpret the Constitution in a way that reflects the drafter's intent. Here, there was no contemporaneous discussion at the time the ERA was enacted indicating that it was intended to bring about same-sex marriage. In fact, a year after the ERA's enactment, the legislature amended a number of statutes to bring them into conformity with the ERA.
Well, the same thing could be said of the 14th Amendment, but you wouldn't suggest that kind of discrimination does not today fall within the breadth of the 14th Amendment, right?
Well, what this court said in Lynch is that it's the most important consideration is to consider what was in the intent of the drafters. And the intent of the drafters for the ERA was not to redefine marriage. Again, it was to...
Yeah, but you're not answering my question. The 14th Amendment was passed after the Civil War. The obvious focus of the 14th Amendment was to rid the country of the vestiges of slavery. Racial-based discrimination. But that doesn't mean that 100 years later we can only focus on that. We move on, don't we, into interpreting the Constitution?
Well, we always will look to the core principles. And the core principle of the ERA is to prevent the government from preferring men as a class over women as a class or vice versa. And again, that simply isn't present here. Other state courts have rejected similar ERA challenges. I would point this court specifically to the Maryland High Court in the Conaway case and the Washington High Court in the Anderson case. Moving next to the Equal Protection Clause claim, our initial argument is that the fundamental right to marry is not implicated here. The fundamental constitutional right to marry...
Do you agree that there is a fundamental right to marry?
There certainly is under the federal constitution. This court, to the best of my knowledge, has never spoken to the question of whether there's a fundamental right to
marry. Shouldn't we agree there is a fundamental right to marry?
I see no reason why this court shouldn't agree that such
a fundamental right... Why shouldn't you be able to marry the person you choose?
Well, this court, I believe, should follow the U.S. Supreme Court's guidance in Glucksberg. In that case, the Supreme Court said it's important when engaging in fundamental rights analysis to provide a careful description of the right at issue. Here, the right at issue is the right to marry a person of the same sex. Looking at past cases, the right at issue...
In Loving versus Virginia, was it the right to marry, or was it the right to marry a person of an opposite sex? Opposite race. You're familiar with that case, aren't you?
I am, Your Honor.
Where the United States Supreme Court struck down the anti-miscegenation law of Virginia and a number of other states that said you can marry anybody you want as long as it's not a person of an opposite race. Correct?
I don't know that the court said
treated
exactly
everybody alike. The Supreme Court in that case didn't confine it to anti-miscegenation laws. It said the right to marry is like the right to procreation. It is a fundamental aspect of personal liberty that is protected, in that case, by the 14th Amendment.
But
the right to marry, not the right to marry someone of a different race.
Right, but the fundamental rights analysis needs to provide a careful description of the right at issue. So it can't just be, if this court were to adopt a very broad understanding of the fundamental right to marry, it would threaten not only the gender definition of marriage, it would threaten other well-established limitations on marital choice.
Such as what?
Your concern is polygamy?
I think as a matter of logic, it would threaten that limitation as well. And not just that limitation, it would also threaten limitations on consanguinity and potentially other ones. And that's of specific interest to this court because it would create tension between a broadly created fundamental right and Article 21, Section 1 of this state's constitution, which prohibits polygamy in this state.
Is your concern that the state cannot come up with a compelling state interest to prohibit polygamy?
My concern is that the fundamental right should not be expanded in such a way that it would threaten such a well-understood limitation.
Why shouldn't the state be put to a test to defend such a prohibition? I don't know what the test would be. I presume they could come up with one. But are you saying that the state should have a free pass and not have to defend a prohibition like that? I mean, if we had plaintiffs before us dealing with polygamy and we had new analysis and new arguments, freed from 50, 70 years of law and bias, really, why shouldn't we take a fresh look at that?
Well, I don't know that this court could because of Article 21, Section 1, which says polygamous or plural marriages are forever prohibited.
So that's beyond the scope of this discussion, then, correct?
It is, except to the extent that a broad understanding of the fundamental right to marry threatens many well-established limitations on marital choice.
Well, except the federal constitution overrides all that, as you just pointed out. Are we talking about here the distinctions between who can engage in a marriage ceremony within the state or who can live in a married status within the state?
We are talking here about who can have a marriage solemnized in this state.
Well, because New Mexico statutes 41-4, 40-1-4, like the common law and like cases and statutes all over the country, says that all marriage is celebrated beyond the limits of the state, which are valid according to the laws of the country where they're celebrated or contracted, shall be likewise valid in this state and have the same force if they've been celebrated in accordance with the laws in this state. That's been construed to recognize same-gender marriages that are contracted outside the state, correct?
That's correct.
And so people can come and live here and have children, not have children, live their lives, inherit, have community property and all that as same-gender couples if they just fly to L.A., get married, and come back here the same day, correct?
Under the current construction of the law.
That's what the legislature has done now. So basically, the prohibition in New Mexico is don't do it within our sight. Don't have the ceremony in front of us. But if you want to go to another state and come back, then you get all the benefits. That's basically the legislative policy, if you're correct.
I would respectfully disagree with that, Your Honor.
Which part of that is wrong?
Well, because the rational concerns that we talked about in the last portion of the argument, that the legislature could have about redefining marriage from a gendered institution to a genderless institution, those are created by the very redefining of the nature of the institution. That doesn't occur unless the legislature changes marriage as it's understood in this state and as it's recognized by the laws of this state. So as we look at the issue, the concerns that the legislature might have over redefining marriage don't happen until the statutes here change, because that's what changes the public meaning of marriage, and that's what creates the concerns, the rational concerns that some legislatures have.
Even though, as Justice Daniels said, every one of these plaintiffs could today fly to Los Angeles, fly to Boston, fly to a dozen other states, get married, return, and the future people can do the same thing and live openly, and they're within the law, correct?
Currently, yes. But the legislature could, of course, change that policy. The legislature could enact a statute if it deemed in the best interest.
The legislature could always do a lot of things. They could say that same-sex marriage is illegal, but they haven't said that.
That's certainly correct, but it's
in fact, they refused to change the statute specifically with regard to same-gender marriages contracted out of state. You found that in your research, didn't you?
That's correct.
Right. They've declined to change the statute even after the same-gender marriages started being contracted out of state and recognized here.
That's correct.
So that's the current legislative situation.
It is.
On those out-of-state marriages that are being recognized and enforced in this state.
It is, but it's up to the legislature to decide what is the best policy for this state. And they can rationally conclude that they can allow those marriages to be recognized here, but they can have...
You're missing my point. How is it rational to have a statutory scheme that says it's okay for you to get married and to live together as married and have the benefits that we give to married couples? It's just not okay to do it within our view.
It's rational, as I said before.
On the day of the ceremony alone.
It's rational because it's the redefining of marriage in the laws of this state that change the understanding of the institution and thus create the concerns. Currently, there hasn't been that redefinition of the law in this state. And that's why it's rational to allow out-of-state marriages to be recognized while to treat in-state marriages differently. That's a rational decision for the legislature to make.
Is it appropriate to apply the rational basis test to a fundamental right that you've conceded exists in marriage?
Well, let me make sure I'm clear on that, because I don't want to mislead the court to our position. Our position is that the fundamental right to marry is the right to enter the relationship of husband and wife. The relationship at issue here is the right to marry a person of the same sex. So we do not believe
that. Let's get past that, because we don't agree with that. So
I wanted to clarify that point to make sure that the court wasn't understanding a concession on
right.
that point. So we do believe it's proper to apply the rational basis test because the fundamental right is not at issue here. Because it's incumbent upon the judiciary to provide a careful description of the fundamental right.
And do you agree that we have historically in New Mexico provided broader protections under the Equal Protections Clause than our federal counterpart?
I would agree with that this court has done that in some instances. But if we're moving from the fundamental rights question to the sensitive class analysis, our position, as we've laid out in our brief, is that the class at issue here, same-sex marriage, same-sex couples seeking to marry, are not a sensitive or suspect class. And specifically, we focus on the political power aspect of the analysis. And when we look at that issue, we see that the National Democratic Party has included same-sex marriage as part of its platform. So has the Democratic Party here in New Mexico. The President of the United States supports same-sex marriage. Over the last 5 years, seven state legislatures have voted for same-sex marriage. Just last year alone, the people in three states approved same-sex
marriage. And there's still a great deal of opposition, correct?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
It's still a great deal of opposition.
There certainly is, because it's a fundamental social institution, and people have different beliefs on how that social institution should develop.
Have you read this court's opinion in Breen versus Carlsbad Municipal Schools?
I have, Your Honor.
And seen the analysis and the opinion that relates to the very argument you're making, that the group that's being discriminated against doesn't have to show that it's politically powerless or that it's made strides since the worst days of its discrimination. But showing a history of discrimination is important to understanding whether to apply intermediate scrutiny. Isn't that correct?
That is part of the analysis. But this court also indicated two other things that I would highlight for this court. If I see I'm over my time.
You get to answer questions.
I get to answer questions. The two things that I would highlight are, first, in paragraph 21 of Breen, this court said the ultimate question is whether the class at issue warrants a degree of protection from the majoritarian political process. Secondly, in paragraph 18 of the Breen decision, this court did acknowledge that the class doesn't have to be entirely without political power, but it did say that the group had to be limited in its ability to advocate within the political system. And our position, as we've laid out in our brief, is that the group at issue here is not so situated.
Of the states that have authorized same-sex marriage, how many have done so through the legislative or voting process, and how many have done so through the courts?
Your Honor, this is going to be a very close approximation, but I won't swear to this. Seven states have enacted same-sex marriage through legislation. Three states have enacted same-sex marriage through a direct vote of the people. So those would both fall within the people making the decision, whether themselves directly or through their elected representatives. And then I believe there are approximately four or five others where the changes come through the courts, which I think highlights for this court that it's important for this change, if it's to occur, that it should come through the legislature.
I have one more question, if I may, Chief.
I keep talking and I keep inviting it, don't I?
we're interested in what you had to say, and that's one of the reasons we wanted you to be able to appear here as amicus, because
thank you, Your Honor.
We want to hear all the views on this case. One case that's sort of like the legal elephant in the room that's not being mentioned is the case of the nine justices on the Potomac, the United States Supreme Court, that was just handed down a few months ago, United States versus Windsor, both a majority opinion and Justice Scalia's interesting dissent, which I'm sure you've read.
I have, Your Honor.
Indicate that the Equal Protection Clause may prohibit state bans against same-sex marriage. You didn't address that in your brief. Would you like the opportunity to do that here before we figure it out without your help?
Sure. I would love the opportunity. First, I would highlight that our opponents don't argue that they're not raising a federal equal protection claim here.
No, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about no federal equal protection claim.
It's my reading of their briefs is that they're not raising that claim here. They are raising a state claim.
Right.
But to answer the question about Windsor,
our state constitution has to provide at least the protection that the federal constitution has to provide.
That's correct.
Correct.
But here there are at least two significant reasons why Windsor doesn't compel this state to recognize, to redefine marriage. The first point is that Windsor recognized that states are the preeminent authority over the definition of marriage. So just as in the Windsor case, the state of New York had the right to redefine marriage to include same-sex couples, so this state has the right to retain the traditional definition of marriage. That's my first point. My second point is that the Supreme Court focused time and time again on the novel and unprecedented nature of the federal DOMA law that it struck down. In other words, it found that for the first time ever, the federal government had interjected itself into the definition of marriage, and it found that that was improper. Here, however, there is nothing novel or unprecedented about the legislature deciding to retain marriage as the union of a man.
So you disagree with Justice Scalia's very clearly stated view that the inevitable result of the opinion of a majority of his colleagues on the United States Supreme Court was that equal protection would prohibit state bans on same-gender marriage.
We disagree with that. In fact, I would direct the court instead to Chief Justice Roberts' dissenting opinion, which specifically says that the Windsor decision and its holding, and the court was really clear in its holding that it was confined to just when a state recognizes a marriage and the federal government won't, that that does not control the question of whether states can continue to define marriage as they always have.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
As I indicated earlier this morning, plaintiffs are same-sex couples, and those plaintiffs have been in committed, loving relationships for many, many years. And while in those relationships, they have experienced the indignity of living in a state where the official policy of the state has been that their relationships are less worthy than others. And so they brought their lawsuit only under the New Mexico Constitution, claiming constitutional rights under that document, and that is a document over which this court has the final word. Courts in other states have construed their state constitutions to prohibit same-sex couples from marrying. I might have said that the opposite way I meant that, so let me go back. Other state courts have indeed said that their state constitutions require that same-sex couples are able to be married. And this court should join them in recognizing those important civil rights. The plaintiffs in the underlying case made four constitutional claims. First, equal protection based on sex discrimination. Second, equal protection based on sexual orientation discrimination. Third, due process violations. And fourth, Article 2, Section 4 violations relating to the pursuit and obtaining of happiness. Today, I would like to focus the court on the core of plaintiff's case, and that is equality under the law. And so I'd like to focus on the equal protection based on sex and the equal protection based on sexual orientation. The overarching principle of equal protection.
Do you require a different level of scrutiny?
I believe that they require the same level of scrutiny, Your Honor. Under the ERA, which would be the analysis to use under the equal protection based on sex claim, it is clear that there is a strict scrutiny analysis under the NARAL decision. Secondly, the other way that strict scrutiny can come to be is if there is a fundamental right at issue, no matter what the classification of individuals are or what level of classification they are. As this court has discussed earlier today, the right to marry is a fundamental right under the U.S. Constitution, and it is no different under the New Mexico Constitution. The fundamental right is not a new right, as the amici contend, of same-sex marriage. Rather, it is a right. It is the plaintiffs who happen to be same-sex couples asserting their right to enjoy the fundamental right of marriage. The scope of the fundamental right to marry is defined by the underlying interests it protects, not by history. This court, the Supreme United States Supreme Court indicated in Turner that inmates had a fundamental right to marry. It didn't find a new right to marry called right to inmate marriage. The same is true in Zablocki, where the court indicated that individuals could enter into a second marriage even if they owed child support. And finally, or maybe first, there is Loving versus Virginia, in which the court said that there is a fundamental right to marry, and it applies to all individuals. They did not identify a new fundamental right to interracial marriage, but rather upheld the existing fundamental right to marry.
In my reading of Lovington, I didn't find that language that it was a fundamental to all individuals, because, you know, as that opinion was entered in the 1800s, it refers to man. The freedom to marry has long been recognized as one of vital personal rights essential to the orderly pursuit of happiness by free men. So it's talking by free men.
Yes, Your Honor, and that was using some what we consider antiquated language at this point in terms of free man. But I think that today's reading of the Loving versus Virginia would in fact recognize that the fact that it was a right that was enjoyed by certain parts of the population, let me put it that way, that all parts of that population should be allowed to engage in that right to marry in this case.
Does it make a difference that maybe they were talking about a marriage between a man and a woman as well?
It does not make any difference for this case, Your Honor, because the point I'm using Loving for is that the when this court as well as the Supreme Court has talked about fundamental rights, it is defined those fundamental rights by the underlying interests it protects, not by history or not by the character of the individual who is asserting that right. And the fundamental interests that marriage protects is the right to have your relationship recognized by the government and to enjoy those benefits that the statutes provide to those who are able to get married in a particular state or in another state. As previously indicated by the court...
Is it the right to marry another unrelated person to the exclusion of all others? Is that the right you're talking about?
I'm confused by the unrelated person part of your question, Your Honor.
Well, we have incest laws against
right.
Incest.
Okay.
We have a constitutional provision that prohibits polygamy.
Well, in terms of a fundamental right, if we identify the fundamental right as the fundamental right to marry, then if there are some individuals who are prohibited from participating in that fundamental right, then the state would have to show a compelling state interest as to why that particular individual or why that particular class of individuals is not allowed to participate in that right. And in the case of incestuous marriages, the state could proffer a compelling state interest.
Assuming we agree that it's a fundamental right, are gays and lesbians a suspect class or a sensitive class, and is there a distinction?
The distinction would not make any difference if it is a fundamental right, because we would automatically be engaging in the constitutional analysis under a strict scrutiny analysis. If the court decides to view this as a question where they want to look at the class of the individuals who are being prohibited from marrying, then the court has to decide whether it is a suspect class, gay and lesbians are a suspect class or a sensitive class. And that would determine then the level of scrutiny employed by the court with respect to the constitutional rights being asserted.
Now, it seems to be conceded that marriage is a fundamental right under the U.S. Constitution, but I've read the U.S. Supreme Court opinions and they're all over the place. Fundamental importance. There's only one case, Turner, where the U.S. attorney apparently conceded that it was a fundamental right. But has the U.S. Supreme Court ever come out specifically and said marriage is a fundamental right, other than to speak about it in general terms?
I think that your research is accurate, Your Honor, in that they have, in many cases where they are not talking directly about the right to marry, they have in fact designated the right to marry as a fundamental right, and this court has done the same thing in its cases where it is reviewing either federal law or state law with respect to the right to marry.
There's no case on point then.
Pardon?
There's really no case on point.
There are cases on point in the sense that the U.S. Supreme Court itself has said there is a fundamental right to marry. And the readings of the cases of Turner, Loving, and Zablocki indicate that the analysis used by the court is one that employs heightened scrutiny, which leads one to the understanding they are analyzing a fundamental right.
So if we disagree with you that it's a heightened scrutiny and not an intermediate scrutiny, under an intermediate scrutiny, what is the difference between suspect and sensitive?
It's a difficult distinction, I think, Your Honor, and I think that the court has not been exactly clear. Certainly with respect to suspect class, the court has said that it has to be a group that has long suffered societal discrimination, which applies in this particular situation. And in fact, gay and lesbians were, some of their activities or conduct were in fact criminalized for many years. There were no laws to protect them until 2003, and they continue to face discrimination. And there also is a political powerlessness. And as Justice Daniels indicated, that it's not necessarily that they lose their ability to be a suspect class based on political powerlessness once they get a little bit of political power. It's really the history that you have to look at to determine whether or not they were particularly politically powerless.
When the legislature has passed the Human Rights Act and also hate crimes legislation that recognizes sexual orientation and protects it, why isn't that in and of itself enough to at least give them the category of a sensitive class?
I think that it is a step towards giving them some protection from discrimination, but the fact that the legislature...
I'm saying to categorize it as a sensitive class.
Because
I'm not sure why this is fairly debatable.
In terms of the sensitive class versus suspect class, I think it's debatable because of the history of political powerlessness of those based on their sexual orientation. It's no different than when the court was first looking at disabled individuals or women. They found political powerlessness even though there had been strides. And the fact that the legislature believed in 2003 that gays and lesbians did in fact need to have particular protections under the Human Rights Act or the Hate Crimes Act was indicative of the level of discrimination that existed at the time. And so political powerlessness is just one element that the court looks at in terms of trying to decide whether it is a suspect class or a sensitive class.
How do we measure that, political powerlessness, particularly in this day and age where certainly gays and lesbians are having more of a profound impact on politics, on their views being heard and considered? How do we measure that?
I think it's hard to measure it, Your Honor, but I think that one example of the political powerlessness is the fact that these six same-sex couples had to come to court in order to get a determination of whether or not they could get married, because efforts in the legislature to allow them to get married have been unsuccessful.
How do we know that that wasn't the will of the people, though? A failure to act as being the will of the representatives?
Even assuming that it is the will of the people, if it violates the New Mexico Constitution, this court has to say that it is a violation of the Constitution. And so there are two... there are two co-equal branches of government involved here, the legislature and the court. And there's been a logjam, frankly, in the New Mexico legislature with respect to same-sex couples' rights or same-sex individuals or sexual, lesbians and gays' rights and protections that they need in the legislature. But that doesn't absolve this court of its obligation under the New Mexico Constitution to find that either through a compelling interest strict scrutiny analysis or through a sensitive class intermediate scrutiny analysis that the gays and lesbians who have not been allowed to be married have been denied their constitutional rights.
But don't we have to measure whether they're politically vulnerable?
That's only one element, and the political vulnerability does continue to today. But what's important is, according to this court's decision in Breen, is the history of their political powerlessness. And because they have made strides, doesn't move them from one level of classification to another level of classification. Given the history of discrimination and the long-suffering societal discrimination is sufficient to determine that it is, in fact, a suspect class.
Let me clarify something for the record. Your claim is based upon the state equal protection clause. not the federal, correct?
Correct, Your Honor. We have made no federal claims. Right.
And so that, assuming hypothetically we were to agree with you and strike down the state statute and say that under the state constitution, same-sex marriage has to be permitted. And now the governor has said repeatedly that she thinks this should be put to a vote of the people by way of a constitutional amendment. Our ruling would not preclude that, would it?
It would not preclude that, Your Honor. Of course, any ballot initiative or constitutional amendment process through both the legislature and to the people would have to result in a constitutional amendment that was constitutional, if you will, either under the New Mexico Constitution or under the United States federal constitution.
Well, by definition, it would be under the New Mexico Constitution because it would be amending the New Mexico Constitution.
It would be amending the New Mexico Constitution, but depending on how it was worded, it is possible that you end up with two conflicting constitutional provisions.
It would be the labor amendment, though. It's really the only backdrop against a state constitutional amendment is a federal.
Yes, Your Honor.
You just don't want to concede that point.
That's correct, Your Honor. But I do take your point that, you know, whatever the court does in this room today does not preclude what the legislature or the governor may do with respect to advocating for a constitutional amendment with the backdrop of the federal constitution,
right.
Because as this court is well aware, the federal constitution is, if you will, the floor of the constitutional rights required under the New Mexico Constitution. With respect to the governmental interests advocated by the amici, marriage is much more than just a vehicle for legitimate procreation or natural procreation. It is about the relationship between two individuals, whether or not they want to engage in procreation. We do not have a litmus test, if you will, for marriage. Those wanting to get married, do we ask them, are you planning on having children? Are you capable of having children? Are you too old to have children? That has never been done in this state. And
we don't disallow birth control, do we?
No, we do not, Your Honor. And certainly that factors into the whole notion of whether or not marriage should be defined by procreation. And in fact, the definition of marriage in this statute is that it's a civil contract between two contracting parties. And so those contracting parties want their relationship recognized by their community, which brings me to the point raised by Justice
Daniels.
It's not
just a matter of recognition. There are all kinds of statutory benefits, economic and social, that flow from a recognized state marriage, correct?
Absolutely,
and,
Your Honor.
And a denial to other couples who haven't been able to engage in
that. That is correct, Your Honor. And
you
that
were right to
is.
Quote me. I didn't want to interrupt you on that.
That is the second part of the lawsuit that the plaintiffs brought below. And that is that they want an order from the court saying that their marriage that they enter into pursuant to the licenses ultimately ordered are going to be treated equal under the law in New Mexico, so that all the rights and obligations of married individuals are given to them and are part of their relationship. With respect to the recognition piece, it is true that right now two individuals could fly to L.A. and get married and come back, and under the statute cited by Justice Daniels, their marriage should be recognized in the state of New Mexico. The Attorney General has issued an opinion saying that recognition of those marriages should occur. And so it is both the solemnization and the living here in a married state that the plaintiffs actually want in as a result of the lawsuit.
Well, this has become more important since the DOMA case, hasn't it?
Yes, Your Honor.
Because if we're not buried, then they don't benefit from the federal benefits.
That's correct. And there are individuals in this state right now who are being denied federal benefits because New Mexico is not recognized as a state that allows same-sex couples to marry under the law.
Excuse me, Ms. Sanders, there's no denial of any couple, same-sex couples' rights to benefits under state law who have been married in other states. where it's recognized as being lawful?
I don't know of any yet, Your Honor. But what I would say is that after the entry of the judgment by Judge Malott in this case, we needed to go to the Attorney General's office and negotiate that one of our couples, and I'm sure you've read about it, where one of them is terminally ill, we needed to be able to say that if her death occurs while this case is pending, then her death certificate will indicate that she was married, because there were lots of benefits that flowed as a result of that designation on the death certificate. And I use that as an example to say that often the need for marital status arises in emergency situations, in emergent situations. And so it's not a situation where while somebody is dying or needing healthcare decisions made, that an individual ought to find out then that their marriage is not going to be given the same recognition as everyone else's.
May I ask one more question to Ms. Sanders? Explain to me how a civil union differs from a, quote, marriage.
By civil union, if you mean what's also called a domestic partnership,
correct.
It is much different in that it can only address some of the benefits and obligations that marriage in this state provides. And so, as Mr. Fuqua, I think, mentioned, when the legislature was looking at domestic partnership, it did take 900 pages of a bill to identify all those instances that could be easily identified, I guess, so that the word domestic partner could be interjected into a statute that already contained man, wife, spouse, those kinds of terms. And so not all of the rights and obligations of a married couple can actually happen with a domestic partnership under the current.
But doesn't it also represent an inferior status at some level?
It does. It is something that is a second-class marriage rather than a premier marriage. And therefore, it should be that this court decide that all marriages should, once the license is issued and the certificate is returned, then all marriages should be treated equally under the law.
And are domestic partnerships recognized by the federal government and by other states the way marriages are?
They are not, Your Honor. Thank you.
May it please the court, Sean Kniff, Assistant Attorney General, on behalf of the respondent, Judge Alan Malott. I think today provides the court with an opportunity to reflect on the motto that is etched in the panels behind the bench, dedicated to the administration of equal justice under the law. We think that standard accurately encapsulates what's at stake today. For that reason, we focused our briefing on the Equal Protection Clause of the New Mexico Constitution.
To the exclusion of the ERA, right? The Equal Rights Amendment.
We elected not to address that in the brief. That's right. Our view, Justice Daniels, is that the Breen decision in particular provides this court with a straightforward and parallel mechanism to afford the right sought in this case in a way that is complicated under the Equal Rights Amendment. And so that's our position. We understand the attractiveness of applying the Equal Rights Amendment, in particular given that it is particular to the New Mexico Constitution, but we think the most expedient means of finding this right in the most defensible manner is by employing the Equal Protection Clause, and in particular the analysis contained in Breen.
Expediency aside,
yes, sir.
Did Judge Malott, didn't he rely on the Equal Rights Amendment?
He did rely on it.
So
and
you're
also
here defending him. What's your position? What's the Attorney General's position on the Equal Rights Amendment in this case?
Justice Boston, our position is that it doesn't apply, that it isn't the appropriate constitutional basis, that it wasn't the intent of that amendment to prohibit this kind of discrimination, that the but-for reason for this discrimination is sexual orientation and not gender. And again, we understand why Judge Malott relied on the Equal Rights Amendment, and there is a plausible argument to be made in that regard. but we don't think it's the best one, and we don't think it's the reasoning that this court should rely upon.
Hope I didn't put your job in jeopardy.
That statement will probably help me, Justice Butler. Thank you. Our view of the Equal Protection Clause in its barest form is that it protects the citizens of our state, groups in our state, from disparate treatment unless the government can articulate a good reason. As this court articulated in Breen, when that particular group appears to be targeted for no good reason, in particular when it's targeted for reasons that are detached from the ability of that group to function in society, that group is entitled to a heightened level of protection and designation as a sensitive class. It's our view that based upon the straightforward analysis in Breen, that gays and lesbians in the context of this case qualify for intermediate scrutiny protection. There has been, as the court knows, there are three sort of elements that have been developed in New Mexico jurisprudence related to the designation of a sensitive class. And it seems that the most interest from the bench has come with respect to the prong related to political powerlessness. And I think that the Breen Court provides this court with straightforward direction with respect to what that standard means. And first and foremost, it's a relative standard. A group need not be completely politically powerless. This court cited to heightened scrutiny protection extended to African Americans and women after the 1964 Civil Rights Act was passed that protected both. The court remarked that the darkest period of discrimination need not be upon the group in order for it to qualify for specialized protection under the New Mexico Constitution. And the fact that protective measures have been passed by the legislature, in this case the Human Rights Act, the prohibition on law enforcement profiling, criminal enhancements for hate crime offenses targeted against gays and lesbians, are all indicia of a deep-rooted and ongoing discrimination that can't be rectified through majoritarian political processes. In particular, if you look at the composition of our state, you note there are no statewide elected office holders who are openly gay or lesbian. You note a paralysis in our state legislature in addressing the right that's sought here today. The legislature has tried for more than a decade either to define marriage as between a man and a woman, or in the alternative, to extend civil union or domestic partnership rights, or in our most recent session, an attempt was made to put a constitutional amendment before the voters of New Mexico to decide this very question about the authorization of same-sex marriage. I would submit that all of these factors reflect that the majoritarian political processes of our state, the legislature and the governor, cannot function to eliminate this disability, this impermissible, unconstitutional disability that's been imposed on same-sex couples as they seek the right to marriage.
But and there's no argument that gays and lesbians do not have access to that process, which would indicate that they are vulnerable.
I don't understand.
Is there any information that you have to support that they do not have access to that legislative process that would render them vulnerable?
Absolutely not, Justice V. Hill. It's manifest that gays and lesbians are enfranchised in our state, that they have access to the political process.
So the fact that there hasn't been legislation either way, wouldn't that indicate that if they have access, then they should perhaps elect representatives that would pass legislation in support of their position?
Well, the political process hasn't functioned in that regard. It hasn't functioned to eliminate this stalemate. And I think the reasons for that are reflected in other prongs of the sensitive class analysis, and particularly this history of invidious societal discrimination that has, I think, has been largely undisputed in cases in other jurisdictions. I don't think it's honestly disputed in this proceeding. But when discrimination is based on animus that is disconnected from the capacity of that group to contribute to society and is so recent as it is in New Mexico, in fact, until 1975, that discrimination had the imprimatur of the New Mexico legislature and our courts, That suggests a deep-rooted discrimination that is unlikely to be rectified in short order through majoritarian political processes.
If access to the political process were the important criteria, we would not have any suspect classifications. Every race has access to the political process, right? Both sexes have access. It's got to be more than that, right?
I agree, Justice Chavez. I misconstrued my light. The other point I want to touch on, because sort of our side hasn't touched on, is this argument that's been articulated by the amici legislators that marriage is this institution that was created to funnel opposite-sex procreative activities into it. Our position, in addition to the observations by Justice Chavez, that isn't reflected anywhere in the statutory language. In fact, the statute that the legislature drafted is a rather sloppy attempt, if that was the objective, because obviously the right to marriage is extended regardless of one's demonstrated ability to procreate. But we think more importantly is that the amici legislators misconstrue the institutions of marriage and child rearing in New Mexico. I think this court has been at the forefront of recognizing that the institutions of marriage and child rearing are evolving, that traditional notions of child rearing are outmoded. And I direct your attention, I know you know the case well, it's recent, the Chatterjee opinion. I know it isn't a constitutional question there, but in that opinion, the court articulated the viewpoint that the policy interest of New Mexico is not to cabin families into a four-person unit with a mother, a father, and two children. The objective, the state interest, is to ensure that children are in loving familial arrangements, ideally with two parents that care about them, that are committed to them. And so to suggest that somehow this is the purpose of marriage, I think our understanding of that has evolved. I think by its very nature, the equal protection analysis is an evolving rubric. And so I would urge this court to reject that rationale, which is the only one presented. I would also argue that there is a religious component that underscores this argument. It is the sort of 500-pound, 800-pound large gorilla in the room. And courts have touched on this in analogous cases, the Connecticut Supreme Court, and concluded that the court needs to be especially suspect of a discriminatory or an allegedly discriminatory classification that has underpinnings in religious belief. And I think you articulated elegantly in the Chatterjee dissent about how that isn't something that we should disparage or something that we should belittle or ridicule. It is sincerely felt. But it is a characteristic. May I finish mine?
No, you may not.
Thank you very much.
Okay. We have rebuttal.
Couple points I'd like to make. First is, under the rational basis test, any conceivable interest asserted in the case is sufficient, as long as it's rational, to support the law at issue. So whether there's been much discussion as to whether responsible procreation and child rearing is the actual interest, we firmly believe that it is, and we've cited not only 9 decisions, judicial decisions, to support that, but we've cited many writings from judicial scholars, anthropologists, historians that confirm that. But I just want to underscore that under the rational basis test, any conceivable purpose is sufficient.
But is there any empirical data to support that somehow children being reared by same-sex couples are affected, adversely affected in some way?
There are a number of studies showing that on average, children do best when they're raised by their own biological mother and father. Just last year, Professor Mark Rigneris produced the new family structure study.
Well, that's the ideal scenario, perhaps, in terms of the attention that children need, the care that they need. But what is the empirical data that you have to support that raising children in a same-sex family somehow is adverse to the development of children? the healthy development of children as compared to a heterosexual?
The argument we're making is that children do best with their own biological mother and father.
Sure, I understand that.
So we're not arguing that same-sex couples cannot be good parents. That's not the argument at all. The argument here is the ideal. And you asked for what studies. So I specifically would point this court to the new family structure study released by Professor Rignaris last year, where he found significant and consistent distinctions between children raised by mothers in lesbian relationships on the one hand, and children raised in intact biological married home. Specifically, Professor Rignaris, in addition with, I believe, six other scholars, filed an amicus brief discussing the parenting studies with the U.S. Supreme Court in the U.S. versus Windsor case. So if the court is interested in those studies, I would refer
to them. But the real paradigm here is marriage, the heterosexual marriage where you have procreation, and a homosexual marriage where you do not have procreation and you may not have adoption. How can that possibly impact negatively on the procreation that takes place in a heterosexual marriage?
The first point is that for this court's equal protection analysis, it doesn't need to consider whether including same-sex couples is going to create a harm. Instead, the relevant question is whether including same-sex couples is going to promote the government's interest in responsible procreation in the same way that including opposite-sex couples does.
Well, you're changing the purpose of it. You're talking about the purpose being in terms of promoting a heterosexual parent-child relationship. I'm saying you can promote that all you want. The fact that you have other relationships without children has nothing to do with that.
Well, but if you promote equally a home that doesn't have a mother and a father, then inherently you're no longer promoting the biological home as the ideal here in society. Counsel for plaintiffs said that fundamental rights are defined by the underlying interest at issue. Instead, the U.S. Supreme Court and the courts of appeals throughout this state have confirmed that fundamental rights are determined by the deeply rooted history and traditions of this state and of our nation. That can't be said of the carefully described right at issue here, the right to marry a person of the same sex. The Attorney General, in his brief, acknowledges, and rightly acknowledges, that, quote, if the group does possess adequate political power, then the courts will demur and allow the political process to function. Here, same-sex couples seeking to redefine marriage have ample political power. In fact, just 3 weeks ago in this state, a poll was released indicating that 53% of the registered New Mexican voters who were surveyed would vote for and approve same-sex marriage.
Despite that, the legislators won't pass the statute, correct?
They won't, but that can't be the touchstone of political powerlessness. If that were the case,
well,
then...
Well, political powerlessness is not... It doesn't mean a complete vacuum. Have you ever heard of the term being in the closet?
I have, Your Honor.
Why do you think people stay in the closet?
I think that in today's society, that when we're looking at the question of political power, that it's a very different question than it would have been 5 years ago.
You're saying there's no discrimination that exists anymore?
We are not saying that. But we're saying that it has significantly
abated. And isn't that something we take into account? This is a category of our citizens that has suffered a great deal of discrimination in the past and continues to experience discrimination, and that we even have public accommodation laws protecting because of that. Shouldn't we take that into account in deciding whether the exclusion of them from this marriage relationship and the inclusion of childless heterosexual couples, for example, and the exclusion of same-sex couples with children, either adopted or biological children of one of the members of them, whether or not that violates equal protection. Shouldn't we be concerned about that?
This court has indicated in Breen that that's part of the analysis. But again, it emphasized in paragraph 18 that it still must find that the group at issue is limited in its ability to advocate within the political system. And that simply is...
So they should have brought this case 10 years ago. It would have been... And if they were in a weaker position politically, therefore in a better position legally.
Your Honor, that would have changed the suspect and sensitive scrutiny analysis.
They right after Ludwig, and they were soundly rejected throughout the nation until recent years.
But this court's suspect scrutiny and sensitive class analysis focuses on the current political power of the group seeking protection. Thank you.
Thank you.
In this first hour, there was discussion regarding the statutes, including the language in the form at 40-1-18. That language is either mandatory or it's unconstitutional. County clerks seek direction from this court regarding their authority or ability to modify the forms, should this court rule that the marriage contract permits same-sex marriage, either by direct authorization by this court or by remanding the practical aspects of implementation back to Judge Millat. In the second hour, counsel and the court have discussed the impact of our state constitution on the marriage laws of this state. County clerks and the New Mexico Association of Counties do, in fact, seek a clear decision from this court now regarding the scope of the laws on marriage, particularly for county clerks who issue marriage licenses. A clear understanding of our law and their duty permits them to fulfill their oath to serve as public officers. Thank you very much.
I want to thank counsel for your briefing and for your argument this morning. It's very helpful to the court as we begin our discussions. And as I indicated before, we will not be reaching a decision today, but we will be writing an opinion which will issue at a later time. There being nothing further, this court is in recess.
Let's end the court here.